military experts and prominent politicians as an important device for temporizing. Ideally, the board would take a few months to reach any conclusions. During this delaying period, the public information program should provide the news media with all possible news about rehabilitation and relief. There is always a strong and continued interest in such news after a disaster. Within a relatively short time, the interest in rehabilitation tends to crowd out reports about destruction and casualties. If an American bomber launched an unauthorized attack on the Soviet Union, Iclay argued that the United States should avoid public self-implication and delay the release of any details about the accident. Then it should begin secret diplomatic negotiations with the Soviets. Amid the tensions of the Cold War, thanks to a military strategy that made the United States and its NATO allies completely dependent on nuclear weapons, Iclay's thinking reached a perverse but logical conclusion. After the accidental detonation of an atomic bomb, the president might have a strong incentive to tell the Soviet Union the truth and lie to the American people. Fred Iclay's reports on nuclear weapons safety were circulated at the highest levels of the Air Force and the Department of Defense, but his work remained unknown to most weapon designers and mid-level officers. In 1958, Bob Purifoy was a section supervisor at Sandia, working on the electrical system of the W-49 warhead. Development of the W-49 was considered urgent. Lightweight and thermonuclear, the warhead would be mounted atop Atlas, Thor, and Jupiter ballistic missiles. During the rush to bring it into production, Purifoy was surprised to read some of the language in a preliminary safety study of the W-49. This warhead, like all other warheads investigated, can be sabotaged, i.e., detonated full-scale, the Air Force study mentioned in passing. Any person with knowledge of the warhead electrical circuits, a handful of equipment, a little time, and the intent can detonate the warhead. Purifoy hadn't spent much time thinking about nuclear weapons safety. His job at Sandia was making sure that bombs would explode. But the ease with which someone could intentionally set off a W-49 seemed incredible to him. It was unacceptable. And so was the Air Force's willingness to rely on physical security, armed guards, perimeter fences, etc., as the only means of preventing an unauthorized detonation. Purifoy decided that the warhead should have an internal mechanism to prevent sabotage or human error from detonating it. Plans were already being made to incorporate a trajectory sensing switch into the new Mark 28 bomb, and Purifoy thought that the W-49 should contain one too. The switch responded to changes in gravitational force. It contained an accelerometer, a small weight atop a spring enclosed in a cylinder. As G-forces increased, the weight pushed against the spring, like a passenger pushed back against the seat of an accelerating car. When the spring fully compressed, an electrical circuit closed, allowing the weapon to be detonated. In the Mark 28 bomb, the switch would be triggered by the sudden jerk of the parachute's opening. Purifoy wanted to use the strong G-forces of the warhead's descent to close the circuit. A trajectory sensing switch would prevent the weapon from going off while airmen handled or serviced it, since the necessary G-forces wouldn't be present on the ground. A skilled technician could circumvent the switch, but its placement deep within the warhead would make an act of sabotage trickier and more time-consuming. The Army didn't like Purifoy's idea. A switch that operated as the W-49 warhead fell to Earth, the Army contended, might somehow make the weapon less reliable. The Army also didn't like what Sandia engineers called the switch, a handling safety device, or a goof-proofer. Both terms implied that Army personnel were capable of making mistakes. Purifoy thought that sort of thinking was sheer stupidity. But the Army ran the Jupiter missile program and had the final say on its fusing and firing system. Under enormous pressure to complete the design of the warhead's electrical system, Purifoy said to hell with it and simply reversed the direction of the tiny springs. Now the switch would respond to the G-forces of the missile soaring upward, not those of the warhead coming down, and the Army couldn't complain that its control of the fusing and firing system was being challenged. To avoid any hurt feelings, Sandia renamed the switch, calling it an environmental sensing device. At Los Alamos, the issue of one-point safety gained renewed attention as SAC began to fly planes with fully assembled weapons. A young physicist, Robert K. Osborne, began to worry that a number of the bombs carried during airborne alerts might not be one-point safe. Among those raising the greatest concern was the Mark 28, a hydrogen bomb with a yield of about 1 megaton. Any problem with the Mark 28 would be a big problem. The Air Force had chosen it not only to become the most widely deployed bomb in the Strategic Air Command, but also to serve as a tactical weapon for NATO fighter planes. In December 1957, the Fission Weapon Committee at Los Alamos had struggled to define what one-point safe should mean as a design goal. If the high explosives of a weapon detonated at a single point, some fission was bound to occur in the core before it blew apart. And so zero yield was considered unattainable. A naval officer at the Armed Forces Special Weapons Project suggested that the yield of a nuclear weapon accident should never exceed the explosive force produced by 4 pounds of TNT. The 4-pound limit was based on what might happen during an accident at sea. If a nuclear detonation with a yield larger than 4 pounds occurred in the weapons storage area of an aircraft carrier, it could incapacitate the crew of the engine room and disable the ship. Los Alamos proposed that the odds of a yield greater than 4 pounds should be 1 in 100,000. The Department of Defense asked for an even stricter definition of one-point safety, odds of 1 in 1,000,000. The likelihood of a Mark 28 producing a large detonation during a plane crash or a fire, Osborne now thought, was uncomfortably high. The one-point safety tests conducted in Nevada had assumed that the most vulnerable place on a weapon was the spot where a detonator connected to a high-explosive lens. That's why the tests involved setting off a single lens with a single detonator. But Osborne realized that nuclear weapons had an even more vulnerable spot, a corner where 3 lenses intersected on the surface of the high-explosive sphere. If a bullet or a piece of shrapnel hit one of those corners, it could set off 3 lenses simultaneously. And that might cause a nuclear detonation a lot larger than 4 pounds of TNT.